whether he was talking with an Yupik person, he was talking to the Yupik, whether he was talking with a Norwegian. Edward could really feel your heart and respond to it as one human does to another.
Remembering Inupiaq leader Edward Itta. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska Human Rights Commission works to protect LGBTQ citizens from discrimination.
You know, we actually have power to do this without the legislature.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
Former North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta died Sunday in Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow. Family members say the cause was cancer. He was 71. Itta was a powerful voice for North Slope communities. He was perhaps best known for first opposing and then negotiating with Shell when the oil company wanted to drill in the Arctic Ocean. Above all, he insisted that Inupiaq communities have a say in development in the region. In January 2015, he spoke at an Arctic symposium in Seattle.
After all the battles over the wilderness and the oil are done, we are the ones that have to live with the consequences. We are the most directly impacted people, decision makers, policy makers at all levels need to understand that.
As Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, Itta became known for balancing the need for oil development with protecting subsistence.
Itta was one of 11 children. His sister, Brenda Itta Lee, recalls an older way of life with little cash economy dependent on subsistence foods.
And whaling, especially, was very important to Edward.
Itta Lee says she and her siblings grew up with a foot in two worlds, traditional and modern, Inupiaq and English. Her brother became a whaling captain who negotiated with oil companies.
So he could speak just as powerfully in two languages. And not only that, we went to a Western American schooling where we were taught the American way of life. And Edward also mastered how to survive successfully in that setting. So he was very much admired for being bilingual and also bicultural.
It was a crucial skill set when he became mayor of the North Slope Borough in 2005. Interest in the Arctic was on the rise, especially from oil companies. Shell developed grand plans to drill in the Arctic Ocean. But the company hadn't consulted local communities who worried about the impact on marine mammals and especially on the whale migration. Itta wasn't having it. He insisted the Inupiaq have a seat at the table, eventually suing the federal government to demand a more thorough environmental review. Journalist Bob Reese wrote about Itta's long fight and eventual negotiation with Shell in his book, The Eskimo and the Oil Man.
It was too much. It was too fast. It was too soon, Edward said. And here was this mayor that Shell had not even taken into account, who came up with the strategy of challenging them in court, and who brought the second largest oil company on earth to its knees in court, and just stopped them dead.
Reese says Itta agonized over his choices. The North Slope is dependent on oil revenue to sustain its quality of life and public services, and onshore oil production was in decline. Yet the ocean is central to both life and identity, and offshore drilling could threaten it.
He said, well, what if it's me? And he meant more than what if it's me. What if it's me? What if it's my family, he said. What if it's me? What if it's me who stops the oil? Meaning, stops the money, stops the taxes, stops the building. What if it's me? But then a second later, he said, well, but what if it's me who sort of allows the oil? And then something goes wrong. And then we lose the whales.
Rees recalls sitting in on a meeting between Itta and Shell that epitomized that struggle. Itta came back from whaling camp to meet with oil industry executives.
Certainly the last thing that a whaling captain wants to do is leave the camp and go back to town, which he did that day because, and this is the way the book starts actually, Edward is on a snowmobile going back to town and a private jet is on the way up from Houston with the top people in Shell.
The Shell executives wanted Itta to reassure people on the North Slope that drilling would be safe, Rees says. Itta refused, saying Shell hadn't done its homework and hadn't talked to the community.
Well, I will say Edward took their head off. he really did. And it was great to watch as a journalist.
The borough's lawsuit helped force a more thorough environmental review. And over years of negotiations, Itta convinced Shell to build in measures to protect marine mammals, including a pause in exploration during the whale migration. Natural Resources Commissioner Andy Mack worked for Itta during those years as the government affairs director for the North Slope Borough. And did you like working for him, working with him?
Loved it.
And loved
every minute of it.
Why was that?
He's a tremendously powerful example of a person who was really true to his principles but practical. He was also very committed to the people that he worked for.
Bob Rees says, above all, Itta had heart.
And he felt, whether he was talking with an Inupiat person, he was talking to the Yupik, whether he was talking with a Norwegian or a senator or an admiral or an oil person, Edward could really feel your heart and respond to it as one human does to another. And I think that's why he is as beloved as he is. Yeah, he was a leader. Yeah, he had brains. Yeah, he knew how to get through Washington. Yeah, he knew how to do all this stuff. But when you were in a room with Edward, you were two people talking, and you were talking from the heart.
From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
Alaska's Human Rights Commission is taking steps to legally protect members of the LGBTQ community from discrimination. Last week, they passed a resolution that would interpret sex discrimination to include gender identity and sexual orientation. That's the interpretation used by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under Title VII. Catherine Dodge, the acting chair of the commission, says the regulation changes could be examined by a legislative committee, but it would not require approval by the state legislature.
The brilliance of this resolution was, we actually have power to do this without the legislature.
Dodge explains the commission's lawyers will draft regulation changes that will be reviewed by the Department of Law. Then there will be a public comment period.
This really is about starting a conversation around the state. We don't get to just, as a commission, say, this is what we think and go do it. We're developing regulations, and there's a lot of room. There's requirements for public comment all the way along.
It also has to be approved by the governor's office. Commission Executive Director Marty Buscaglia says the interpretation of the regulations would be similar to the non-discrimination ordinances that already passed in Anchorage and Juneau. She says it would make state law more closely reflect changing social views.
Same-sex marriages are taking place, but yet you can go to work and be discriminated against for being married to a same-sex partner. And, that just feels wrong.
Dodge says the resolution also asks the legislature to pass a bill that would protect people based on gender identity and sexual orientation, though she doesn't think they would take it up this year. The presidential race aside, most Alaska voters this election season are probably concerned about races for the legislature and Alaska seats in the U.S. House and Senate. But unless you were part of a recent lawsuit or defendant in a criminal case, you probably don't know much about some of the people on the backside of Tuesday's ballot. KTOO's Matt Miller has more on this year's judicial retention election.
Did you ever wonder why you never see campaign signs for judges like in other states? There are 33 Alaska judges on this year's election ballot, yet probably none of them are producing radio and television ads, putting flyers in the mail, or taking out ads in the newspaper promoting their credentials as a judge and asking to remain on the bench. And for sure, Alaska judges never accept large campaign contributions from lawyers, lobbyists, and special interest groups. Suzanne DiPietro, the executive director of the Alaska Judicial Council, explains how that would be a problem.
It's pretty obvious in other states where judges campaign, the main contributors to the campaigns are lawyers. At that point, when you would go to court, you wouldn't know if the other person in court had actually contributed to the campaign of that judge. And that would be something to worry about. They wanted to avoid it. They also wanted to avoid judges campaigning and being sort of pressed to make certain promises about how they might rule in a case. It's totally inappropriate and not fair.
DiPietro says the code of conduct for Alaska judges prohibits them from campaigning unless they are attacked. Former Alaska Supreme Court Justice Bud Carpinetti says members of the Constitutional Convention 60 years ago wanted to isolate judges from election politics.
Judges have to be primarily responsive to the law. They have to apply the law fairly, and I think the founders wanted to get away from the notion that it would be just another political branch, because when you go into court, sometimes the unpopular side might be the side that has more legal merit and ought to win.
Carpinetti says Tom Stewart, a territorial legislator and secretary to the Constitutional Convention, traveled around the country to research how other states did things, and he came back with something called the Merit Selection Plan, or the Missouri Plan. A nonpartisan panel would interview and thoroughly vet judicial applicants and then hold public hearings. The governor would essentially be the political component representing the people while making the final selection from a short list of best qualified nominees. During retention elections held later, voters have a direct say on whether they think each judge is still doing a good job.
So the council's process really starts a whole year in advance.
The Alaska Judicial Council is the nonpartisan panel responsible for putting all applicants and sitting judges through a fine-tooth comb.
The council tries to determine how a judge performed in office over their last term in office by surveying people who've appeared in front of that judge. So the idea is that the people who have been in the judge's courtroom, who've read the judge's decisions, those are the people who are going to be able to give the council the most up-to-date information about the judge's performance.
DiPietro says the council is recommending all 33 judges on the ballot this year be retained.
It's a lot more than usual, and that's just really a coincidence. It's almost half the judges sitting in Alaska right now.
DiPietro recommends that voters consider each judge's performance and body of work and not whether they agree or disagree with the outcome of a single case. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to stop African elephant poaching is hurting walrus ivory carvers in Alaska.
Once they realized that something was made out of ivory, you could tell that there was almost a disdain, a look of disdain.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
More Alaskans than ever are eligible to cast ballots this year thanks to record-high voter registration. The state added 22,000 registered voters compared with 4 years ago, for a total of 528,560. That's up 4%. And while most Alaskans are nonpartisan or undeclared, most of the new voters are Republicans or Democrats. The Republicans added a little more than 6,000 voters since 2012, while Democrats gained just over 5,000. Among third parties, the Alaska Independence Party gained registered voters over the past 4 years, while the Libertarians and Greens lost ground. The deadline to register was October 9th. If your habit on election night in Anchorage was to roll down to the Egan Center and watch the returns projected huge onto the wall, forget about it. The Alaska Division of Elections has discontinued Election Central due to budget constraints, but you don't have to weep or cheer at home alone. APRN's Liz Ruskin tells us who is going to be where on election night.
Across America, we are sorting ourselves into silos. More and more, Republicans and Democrats associate with their own kind. So it goes, too, with election night in Anchorage, now that there's no state-sponsored neutral zone. The Republican Party plans its shindig at the top of the world at the Hilton Hotel on 3rd Avenue. The Democrats will be partying three blocks away at Willowa at 6th and F. The Trump-Pence campaign will be right across the street at Flat Top Pizza. Senator Lisa Murkowski's people will be at the 49th State Brewing Company, and challenger Joe Miller's folks will be in the conference room at Davis Constructors. Senate candidate Margaret Stock, in keeping with her independent billing, plans to shuttle between the Republicans at the Hilton and the Democrats at the Willowa. If you want nonpartisan, one option is the Beartooth Theater Pub on Spinard Road. General Manager Stephanie Johnson says with the Egan Center dark on election night, they sensed a void.
The more we thought about it, the more we thought that we might be able to be a really nice, inviting, neutral place for people from all over the community.
The Beartooth is inviting campaigns and their supporters, politicos, and the politically curious to mingle over beer. Word to the wise, the event announcement says courteous behavior is expected. Johnson says she doesn't foresee any trouble.
I would put it on the same level of our concern when we host the Super Bowl. We know that people have deep-rooted passions and feelings about who wins, but in the end, you know, we're all in it together.
If this election doesn't drive you to drink, it might prod you to prayer.
This election season has been kind of rough for all of us. And so we're doing something to counteract that.
That's Reverend Rachel Simpson of Unity of Anchorage, issuing an invite on YouTube to her church on East 68th Street. On Election Day, Unity is holding a nonpartisan prayer vigil.
On the hour, every hour, our prayers will be led by different faith leaders from the area.
To maintain neutrality, Simpson says no political content will be permitted beyond the I voted sticker. The vigil is planned for the entire time polls are open in Alaska, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Recent measures to curb elephant poaching in Africa are having unintended consequences in Alaska. This July, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's near-total ban on the commercial ivory trade went into effect. State-level bans passed in California, Hawaii, New Jersey, and New York, and it's already starting to hurt Alaska's ivory market. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, hunters and artists expect it to get worse.
Among dozens of tables at the craft fair during the AFN convention in Fairbanks, the glitter and gleam of Dennis Pungawi's ivory stands out. He's got everything from small sculptures of birds to curved cribbage boards etched into tusks.
I'm more well known for my walruses, though. These bigger ones are from a 10-pound tusk, and I only get maybe two or three of those tusks a year.
Pungawi's family is from Savunga, which, along with Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, accounts for the vast majority of walruses harvested each year, between 4 and 1,200 animals. The primary reason for the hunt is food, but the sale of tusks and carvings helps bring in cash.
Almost every household has at least one carver there.
Pungawi lives in Wasilla for most of the year, in part to have better access to the ivory market. But his livelihood still depends on regular trips to Savunga each spring to hunt and buy raw tusks to work on throughout the year. Since the summer, Pungawi says federal and state-level regulations cracking down on the domestic market for elephant ivory have caused people to think all ivory is illegal.
Yeah, we've taken a pretty big hit on this elf and ivory ban. People are getting mistaken with it, with walrus ivory, because they're not explaining and getting it out there.
At some of the other tables, sellers say they've heard of the bans but haven't started seeing an impact yet. Pongawi thinks that'll change this year when ivory buyers go out to villages. Alarm bells are already beginning to sound. During AFN, U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan convened an official field hearing to assess what can be done.
While perhaps well-intentioned, these state bans have had the unintended consequences of limiting the ability to trade in authentic articles of native handicraft. And in other cases, they have created confusion.
Regional leaders testifying at the field hearing said not only are they seeing ivory prices drop, but there's been an uptick in unlawful confiscations by federal agents. Melanie Banke is president of COWERIC, the regional nonprofit in the Bering Strait region. Like Pongawi, Banke is from Savunga and has siblings whose carvings help pay for clothing and heating oil. She says this summer, COWERIC flew in carvers for a craft fair to greet wealthy tourists when the Crystal Serenity cruise ship docked in Nome. But nobody bought anything.
Once they realized that something was made out of ivory, you could tell that there was almost a disdain. A look of disdain.
Alaska has a robust internal market for walrus ivory, where subsistence hunting isn't controversial and the use of marine mammal products is common. But carvers rely on commerce with outside states. Banke says even though California and New York are far away, the drop in demand means Alaska ivory isn't making it to market, an effect she and others worry could be devastating to rural communities like Savunga.
It can be a huge part of a family's income, whether it's an $80 carving or an $8,000 carving. When our communities are already living below poverty, that's a big source of income for our people.
But conservationists say the demand for ivory that's funneled cash from tourists, merchants, and galleries back to Alaskans is the same one threatening to wipe out elephants in Africa.
We're talking about the survival of a species. And just given the current poaching crisis, we're trying to close as many loopholes as we can to get the situation under control.
Ellie Pepper works for the Natural Resources Defense Council, one of the national conservation groups that's lobbied state legislatures on ivory bills. She says a spike in elephant poaching over the last decade, driven primarily by surging demand in China, is at unprecedented levels. And while the U.S. has long outlawed the sales of new elephant ivory, there were enough allowances to fuel a black market.
The U.S. has historically allowed the sale of old or antique elephant ivory. That created a huge loophole that led to a parallel illegal market because it's very difficult to distinguish ivory date.
Pepper says the four state-level bans that have passed do technically include exemptions for walrus ivory harvested by Alaskan natives, but she concedes that in the rush to de-glamorize ivory overall, those nuances may have gotten lost.
I think most people have tried to make it pretty specific to elephant ivory, but I think, you know, the messaging has maybe been conflated.
Alaskans don't have a lot of options for recourse over bans passed in other states. Subsistence advocates are recommending language in state bills that more explicitly acknowledges the rights of Alaskan natives, along with a public relations campaign highlighting the sustainable nature of walrus ivory. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
When you think of the Pribilof Islands, what food comes to mind? Probably not produce. The people of St. Paul Island are working to change that. With a federal grant, they've built a greenhouse, and it's so productive, they're giving away the produce. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
St. Paul's greenhouse isn't what you'd imagine. There's no big glass structure. All the windows are covered from the inside. It's underneath the city's grocery store, on the first floor of a building. It's hydroponic. Blue and red LED lights hang suspended above the plants. Pumps fill the room with white noise.
Just trying to find a big one.
Dallas Roberts manages the greenhouse. He drops by on a recent afternoon to harvest 6 heads of lettuce.
Yeah, he's been growing for at least close to like a month and a half. And they're fantastic.
The 19-year-old grew up on the island. He says the availability of fresh produce is a big deal in St. Paul. There's only one shelf for it in the grocery store. Lauren Devine is the co-director of ECO, the tribe's environmental conservation office. She says problems with cargo shipping mean that by the time vegetables hit the shelves, they're already rotten.
I mean, we ran out of like carrots and potatoes and onions that are cold cellar, long storage type vegetables, and they were spoiling and going bad.
St. Paul's greenhouse was built with more than $400,000 in federal grant money. The goal is to produce high-quality, affordable food for the community. At first, the idea was to build a traditional, all-glass greenhouse. But when Devine joined the project, she scrapped those plans because she didn't think it was sustainable. A box greenhouse kit would have to be barged in, and because St. Paul is volcanic, the same would be true for fertilizer and topsoil.
It took a lot to change everybody's mind from thinking of, like, they were going to see this glass building to coming into a hydroponics operation and seeing the lettuce grow without soil in this very different, almost alien-looking way.
The cost of running the hydroponic greenhouse is so low, they're giving away the produce. The electric and water costs are covered by the Aleut community of St. Paul tribal government. Plants can grow inside the greenhouse year-round. Right now, they're producing about 60 heads of lettuce a week. Plus, there's tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, cilantro, and more. There's even an outdoor garden with potatoes and kale. Devine says kids are some of the biggest advocates for the greenhouse. They even ask their parents to get lettuce.
When you can sit down and have a meal with rutabaga and seal and potatoes and carrots, and it's all coming from St. Paul, then it really shifts their view of subsistence too. It can be all food. You know, it can be all the food that we grow, and I can grow this at my house, or I can come down to the garden and harvest it, and it's from here and it's our food.
There have been problems. The heat in the greenhouse is provided by the grocery store above. When the business adjusts the temperature, it can kill the crops. But demand for the produce is so strong, Devine has plans to expand. She has her eyes on a new warehouse space that could fit a greenhouse twice the size of the current one. That may allow ECO to sell the extra to Trident, the local fish processing plant, for their salad bar. For now, the greenhouse staff gives away the vegetables. They can donate to the food bank and share with elders. Remember those 6 heads of lettuce Dallas Roberts cut? A few minutes after he harvests them, he delivers them to the local tavern.
Might have to wash it, but okay. They're the best ones we got.
The cooks will use it for tomorrow's dinner. Thanks. Indian tacos. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in St. Paul.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz, Ann Hillman, Andrew Kitchenman, Liz Ruskin, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Juneau, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Our editor and producer is Sean Dugan. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.